Hello, this is Betsy Waugh, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the Thursday, October 16th issue of the Democrat and Chronicle on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Milder fall, early winter predicted. Above average temperatures likely for New York, NOAA says. That's the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. By Victoria E. Friel, New York Connect Team, USA Today Network. While it may feel like the cooler autumnal weather has just arrived in New York, the winter months are not far away. You may, however, be able to delay digging out your snow gear this season, since the forecast calls for a potentially mild fall and early winter. The annual National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's U.S. Winter Outlook Report from the Climate Prediction Center predicts above-average temperatures for much of the country, including New York, through December. The three-month outlook through February in New York does also not call for wetter, drier, or warmer/cooler conditions in New York. The forecast does, however, look to be warmer and drier than average in the southern United States and also predicts a warmer winter in the Northeast. NOAA fall forecast for New York. The National Weather Service forecasts a 40 to 50% chance of above average temperatures across all of New York State this fall, covering October, November, and into December. New York has, quote, equal chances, unquote, for normal precipitation, meaning no specific trend is favored in either direction. This indicates that in these areas, there is no strong likelihood of wetter or drier conditions this fall. NOAA winter forecast for New York. The National Weather Service predicts a 33 to 40% chance of above average temperatures for the eastern part of New York State this winter, covering December, January, and February. This area includes New York City and Long Island, the Adirondacks, and the Hudson Valley. Western and central New York have, quote, equal chances, unquote, for normal temperatures, meaning no specific trend is favored for that same time span. New York State also has, quote unquote, equal chances for normal precipitation, meaning no specific trend is favored for wetter or drier conditions between December and February. Will New York see snowstorms and blizzards this winter? The NOAA winter forecast does not specify how much precipitation will fall as rain, snow, or ice, only that more or less is likely overall. Snow forecasts depend on the strength and track of winter storms, which generally cannot be predicted more than a week in advance, according to Weather Service meteorologists. Old Farmer's Almanac prediction for the 2025-26 winter in New York is this. In New York, some regions, particularly central New York and the southern tier, are expected to see a colder than normal winter, according to the Old Farmer's Almanac. Other parts of the state, including western New York, the Capital Region, Adirondacks, Hudson Valley, and New York City, Long Island, are forecast to experience slightly milder than usual temperatures. Nationwide, the almanac predicts a winter that will be, quote, mostly mild with pockets of wild, unquote, featuring near normal to mild temperatures across much of the U.S. However, certain areas should brace for colder than usual conditions. Civil servants caught up in, quote, loyalty trap, unquote. Federal workers wrestle with whether to stay, speak up, or go. By Jamie L. Kosinskas and Yvonne Zylin, Hamilton College and University of Calgary, from The Conversation. The University of Calgary, provides funding as a founding partner of The Conversation CA, and as a member of the Conversation CA-FR. Hamilton College provides funding as a member of the Conversation US. The Conversation is an independent and nonprofit source of news, analysis, and commentary from academic experts. The Conversation is wholly responsible for the content. For many Americans, work is not just about earning a paycheck. It is a centerpiece of their lives, and they want their job to be meaningful. Decades of research suggest this is true for most federal civil servants who aim to serve not only their organizations and their missions, but also the public and the nation. Over the course of President Donald Trump's first administration from 2017 to 2021, we spoke with dozens of federal civil servants. They described their jobs as a calling aligned with their ideals to serve the government, uphold democracy, and serve the public. Turbulent change during Trump's first term, however, tested many workers. Over a quarter of the civil servants we spoke with ultimately left the federal government. Since the start of his second term, Trump has attempted a far more sweeping overhaul of the federal bureaucracy. More than 50,000 federal workers have been fired or targeted for layoffs. The U.S. Agency for International Development was shuttered, for example, and more than 80% of employees have been fired from AmeriCorps and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Another 154,000 federal workers accepted the government's buyout offers, which are structured as quote-unquote deferred resignations. Yet there are similarities with Trump's first term, such as his and his appointees' attacks on civil servants' loyalty and the administration's efforts to punish dissent. Our interviews from Trump's first term, the basis for the 2025 book, quote-unquote, The Loyalty Trap, may give insight into what civil servants are experiencing today. In some ways, their concerns are unique to government work. Yet they also face a challenge many workers confront during dramatic changes at their organization, regardless of their field, whether to stay or go. The federal civil service is composed primarily of career professionals who work for a mission-driven agency, not just a specific administration. These employees consider themselves nonpartisan, prepared to serve presidents from either party. When a new administration takes over, whether Democratic or Republican, it installs political appointees to lead the agencies that execute federal law. These agencies help develop federal regulations, enforce laws and regulations, provide services, and carry out policies. Career civil servants expect to carry out appointees' instructions and are under legal and ethical obligations to do so. The ethical code and oath of office that civil servants swear to upon starting their positions require them to uphold the Constitution, laws, and ethical principles and to, quote, faithfully discharge the duties of their office, unquote. They may not, quote, use public office for private gain, unquote, and are required to report any, quote, waste, fraud, abuse, and corruption, unquote. Federal employees expect significant changes in policy direction and describe it as part of the job. As one State Department worker told us in 2018, quote, the president is elected by the people and can define his or her own foreign policy. And our job as career officers of the State Department is to enact that person's policy. So I have no problem. I have my own moral questions about what the president's foreign policy choices are, but from a commitment and service oath that I've taken to work at the State Department, it's my job to implement the intent of the president and the Secretary of State. Loyalty trap. Under the first Trump administration, however, many interviewees described a new level of abrupt change in politicization, where personal loyalty to the president seemed prioritized over their agency's missions and norms. Civil servants must abide by the Hatch Act, which forbids some kinds of political activities, like hosting fundraisers, rules meant to shield them from political pressure and keep promotions merit-based. During the first term, however, Trump officials repeatedly violated the Hatch Act, according to a 2021 federal probe. In this environment, during the first Trump administration, quote, loyalty was not to question, unquote, said a senior officer at the Environmental Protection Agency. Amid increasing mistrust and suspicion, she believed that, quote, whenever you raised a question in this environment, you were thought to be leaking as well, unquote. This cut against some civil servants' understanding that it was their job as longtime agency workers and experts to provide the best advice possible. Emphasis on personal loyalty was difficult for some of them to reconcile with loyalty to the missions of their agencies or to the public interest, particularly as many policies took a sharp turn. By January 2021, around three-quarters of the regulations, guidance documents, and agency memos the Trump administration issued that were challenged in court had been invalidated or withdrawn, according to research at New York University. Some civil servants working to bolster democracy around the world and at home, for example, were disturbed by shifts in foreign policy. The president frequently praised authoritarian leaders with poor human rights records, such as Vladimir Putin of Russia, Kim Jong-un of North Korea, and Recep Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey, while giving the cold shoulder to allies in Europe. Quote, the thrust of U.S. foreign policy has generally followed a pretty predictable path, unquote, observed one longtime member of the State Department who had worked under both Republican and Democratic administrations. Quote, this administration has come in and has basically disregarded the overall imperative that we have to promote democracy and to promote transparency, unquote. Around 80% of our interviewees said they were experiencing moral dissonance as a result of the sense that their own values, job standards, and political leaders' expectations did not align. These workers were experiencing what we call a quote-unquote loyalty trap, the sense of being caught between following higher-ups' directives and complying with other professional and ethical obligations. Eyeing the exits. German economist Albert Hirschman's 1970 book, Exit, Voice, and Loyalty, helps explain what workers do when they believe their organization is in decline. Hirschman argued that loyalty to an organization can delay a worker's decision to leave and motivate them to speak up and push for improvement. Other studies since have also examined how loyalty shapes workers' decisions. Research on industries from journalism to mining and taxi operations suggests that when employees feel they have no opportunity to voice dissent and influence the group's direction, even the most loyal workers may eventually decide to exit. However, loyalty to the mission of an organization can shape a worker's decision in complex ways. Sociologist Elizabeth A. Hoffman, for example, studied workers in conventional versus cooperative employee-owned businesses. She found that employees in a cooperative food distribution company who expressed strong allegiance to the company and their co-workers were more likely to mention exiting in response to grievances than their counterparts in a conventional company. She concluded that the cooperative's workers' greater quote-unquote zeal for the group's mission actually made them more likely to consider leaving when they felt frustrated or betrayed. These findings echo themes among civil servants we spoke with who wound up leaving the government, people who valued public service but doubted their power to use their voice to do work as they saw fit. Civil servants' exits can be costly for them and their families, but also for their governments, as public administration scholars have found in countries around the world. Experienced workers' departure can result in the loss of institutional knowledge, and they are often replaced with political loyalists. A 2023 review of almost 100 studies, including research from more than 150 countries, concluded that governments where employees were hired based on education and work experience, not politics, had less corruption, more efficiency, and greater public trust. Under the current U.S. administration, which is openly punishing dissent among civil servants, we expect an even greater number of employees to contemplate departure. Again, this article is from The Conversation by the University of Calgary and Hamilton College, and they are an independent and nonprofit source of news, analysis, and commentary from academic experts. The Conversation is wholly responsible for the content. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Democrat and Chronicle on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Ontario fugitive caught in Pennsylvania. Former Geneva American Legion Post commander accused of grand larceny by Mike Murphy, Canandaigua Daily Messenger, USA Today Network, from Geneva. After missing a court date last month, a former commander of Geneva American Legion Winnick Post 396 visited his sister in Tennessee for several days, switched vehicles, and then traveled to Pennsylvania, where he is accused of writing threatening letters to a relative in Ontario County and two witnesses in the felony grand larceny case against him. That's how Ontario County Sheriff David Cicerone, C-I-R-E-N-C-I-O-N-E, characterized Dale H. Mosher's day on the run until his arrest October 13th in Pennsylvania. Mosher, who Cicerone said had a leadership role in the Geneva Post for years and who was entrusted to run not only the organization but also its finances, was indicted earlier this year on a second-degree grand larceny charge, which is a Class C felony. Cicerone thanked the public for quote-unquote crucial information that helped lead to Mosher's arrest, as well as the efforts of law enforcement partners in three states, particularly the sheriff's office's own warrant unit, Sergeant Seth Jones, and deputies Patrick Fitzgerald, Zednik Chumacero, and Brian Garman, who worked the case 24/7 to locate and apprehend Mosher. Quote, "The joint efforts of so many are why Mr. Mosher is in custody this morning," unquote, Cicerone said at a press conference October 14th. What we know now, Mosher was taken into custody shortly after 2:30 p.m. October 13th without incident by the Hemlock Township Police Department as he attempted to enter a Walmart parking lot in Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania. He was in custody at the Columbia County Prison pending extradition proceedings at the time of the press conference. Ontario County First Assistant District Attorney Kelly Wolford said Mosher could be arraigned sometime this week. Mosher was originally arrested in April 2024 after an internal financial audit of the Veterans Organization and 10-month investigation involving the Ontario County Sheriff's Office. Mosher was accused of stealing more than $100,000 from the organization dating back to 2018. In announcing the indictment earlier this year, the district attorney's office said the money was taken in small amounts at a time and was believed to be for his own use. Cicerone said Mosher had been attending all of his scheduled court appearances until last month when he failed to appear for a scheduled court appearance. A bench warrant for his arrest was issued. Mosher's trial was set for this month, at which, if he was found guilty, he could have faced up to 15 years in jail. The days leading up to Dale H. Mosher's arrest. Mosher had been moving around between the Harrisburg and Gettysburg areas in Pennsylvania, Cicerone said. The letters were processed and postmarked in a mail facility in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Two of the handwritten letters contained death threats, Cicerone said. Quote, "Obviously this ratcheted up our concern and the public safety threat," unquote, Cicerone said. Over the weekend, investigators developed credible information that Moshe remained in central Pennsylvania in the area of a rest stop near Hemlock Township. Further charges are being investigated, Cercioni said. Impact on Geneva American Legion Winnick Post 396. Cercioni said Moshe's violation of trust caused tremendous harm to the American Legion community and is hopeful that his apprehension is another step forward in the right direction of this healing process. Cercioni said that while people suspected that Moshe was up to no good, many were afraid to confront him. Quote, he was a bully straight up, Cercioni said, adding that current commander, A.J. Fratto, stood up to it. Fratto, who alerted the sheriff's office to the alleged financial irregularities, said he is grateful to the efforts in capturing the, quote, disgraced commander, unquote. The case also serves as a lesson that when something is wrong, quote, unquote, you have to fix it, Fratto said, adding that there is now two-person integrity on, quote, unquote, everything we do. Quote, we've done everything we can do to build trust in the organization, unquote, Fratto said. The reporter, Mike Murphy, covers Canandaigua and other communities in Ontario County and writes the Eat, Drink, and Be Murphy food and drink column. Follow him on X at MPN-MikeMurphy. Online talk offered by FLCC, the Finger Lakes Community College, explores the end of World War II. By the Canandaigua Daily Messenger, USA Today Network, from Hopewell, New York. Finger Lakes Community College will host an online talk by a professor of history and author who will speak about the closing days of World War II. The talk at 7 p.m., October 21st, will be available on the WebEx video conferencing platform, the Finger Lakes TV network, and YouTube. Links are available on the FLCC website calendar at flcc.edu/events. Tom Zeller, professor of history at the University of Colorado Boulder, will focus on the final battles, diplomacy, and tragedies of the Pacific War, asking whether the atomic bomb was necessary. Zeller is the author of Unconditional Defeat, Japan, America, and the End of World War II, and also the author of Annihilation, A Global Military History of World War II. His latest book, Beyond the Nixon Shocks, explores the demise of the American century. It will be available in December. Zeller's talk is part of the History, Culture, and Diversity series organized by Robert Brown, FLCC Professor of History. It marks the 80th anniversary of the end of World War II. Hochul rejects restart of nuclear plant. Governor addresses talk regarding Indian Point in Westchester County by Thomas C. Zambito, New York State Team, USA Today Network. Governor Kathy Hochul may have warmed to the idea of adding more nuclear power to the New York's energy mix, but her plans don't include restarting Westchester County's Indian Point power plant. Quote, let me say this plainly, no, unquote, Hochul writes in a letter sent last week to Westchester County Executive Kenneth Jenkins, obtained by the USA Today network. Quote, there have been no discussions or plans, and I would not support efforts to do so, unquote. Hochul's stance applies not only to traditional reactors once in use at Indian Point, but smaller, state-of-the-art modular reactors, viewed by some as an alternative less likely to encounter opposition. Those reactors, while still years away from being wide-scale commercial use, don't come with the same baggage as traditional reactors, whose cooling towers became symbols of nuclear disaster after a partial meltdown at Pennsylvania's Three Mile Island plant in 1979. Hochul's letter to Jenkins, a fellow Democrat facing re-election, was meant to quiet talk of a reopening that surfaced in recent weeks when Indian Point's current owner, Holtec International, responded to questions about a possible restart by saying, quote, with time and money, anything can happen, unquote. Shut down too soon. Restarting the Buchanan plant, which shut down in 2021 after nearly six decades generating electricity for New York City and Westchester, would take 4 years at a cost of between $8 billion and $10 billion, Patrick O'Brien, Holtec's government affairs representative, said. The estimate was based on Holtec's recent experience restarting the Palisades nuclear plant in Michigan. Hochul's letter to Jenkins reiterates comments first made this summer in an interview with the USA Today Network when the governor said the plant was shut down before clean energy alternatives were ready to fill the energy gap. The shutdown has led to near total reliance on fossil fuels for the downstate region's energy needs, a development predicted by the plant's previous owners. The decision to close and decommission Indian Point precedes my administration and I believe was done in haste, Hochul writes. Quote, we lost 25% of the power that was going to New York City without having a plan B in place. Emissions have risen as a result, but the answer is not reopening Indian Point or considering other nuclear options for the site, unquote. The solution lies, she said, in finding new sources of clean energy, such as the Champlain-Hudson Power Express, a transmission line that will deliver power to New York City from Canada by way of hundreds of miles of underwater cable coursing down the Hudson River. The agreement to shut down Indian Point was brokered in 2017 by former Governor Andrew Cuomo, who cited fears of a nuclear mishap some 30 miles north of New York City, the most densely populated part of the state. His administration said the plant's energy supply would be covered by gas-powered generating plants, acting as a bridge to a future when renewables like wind and solar power were more widely available. But the renewal bucket has been slowed by resistance to large-scale wind and solar farms in upstate towns and transmission lines needed to deliver that energy downstate, coupled with delays in building wind farms off the coast of Long Island. Nuclear power coming to upstate. Hochul's, quote, unquote, all of the above vision for the state's energy grid includes the addition of more nuclear power upstate, which already is home to three plants on the shores of Lake Ontario, two near Oswego, and a third east of Rochester. She's asked the New York Power Authority, the NYPA, and the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority to develop a plan to add 1 gigawatt of power, enough for around 1 million homes upstate. Quote, any new plant must be located in upstate communities that want such a project, unquote, Hochul's letter to Jenkins added. Several upstate communities have already expressed interest, according to Justin Driscoll, the president and CEO of NYPA. Downstate, state lawmakers from the lower Hudson Valley have aligned themselves with environmental groups like Riverkeeper and Food and Water Watch to oppose the reopening of Indian Point. Last month, Jenkins said restarting the Indian Point was a quote-unquote a hard no. Quote, we've been through this once and we still are feeling the impacts and we're not doing it again, unquote, Jenkins said. The reporter, Thomas C. Zambito, covers energy, transportation, and economic growth for the USA Today Network's New York State team. He's won dozens of state and national writing awards from the Associated Press, Investigative Reporters and Editors, the Deadline Club, and others during a decades-long career that's included stops at the New York Daily News, the Star-Ledger of Newark, and the Record of Hackensack. He can be reached at tzambito, it's spelled T-Z-A-M-B-I-T-O, at lohud.com. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Democrat and Chronicle on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Obituaries. Betty Lou Clark, in parentheses it says Monk, Clon Hennick, spelled M-O-N-K, KLAHNHENNIK, aged 84, in Rochester, New York, passed on October 9th. Arrangements are through the newcomer, cremations and funerals. Service time is October 19th at 2:30 p.m. at the newcomer, cremations and funerals location. Mary Dennis, age 92, in Rochester, New York, passed on October 13th. Arrangements are through the Thomas Funeral Chapels Incorporated. The service time is October 18th at 4 p.m., and the service location is the Thomas Funeral Chapels. Susan Reeves Huette, H-U-E-T-T-E, in Chilai. Arrangements are through the J.H. Cameron Funeral Home. Ruth Anderson Lawrence, M.D., in Rochester, New York, passed on October 12th. Arrangements are through the Anthony Funeral and Cremation Chapels. Service time is October 18th at 10 a.m., and the service location is St. Thomas More Church. Joan M. Lowry, L-O-W-R-E-Y, in parentheses, Cipriano, C-I-P-R-I-A-N-O, aged 89, in Greece, New York, passed on October 12th. Arrangements are at the Bartholomew and Parada Funeral Home. Service time is October 18th at noon. Service location is St. John the Evangelist Church, and the interment is the Holy Sepulchre Cemetery. And Stephen Pierce, aged 65, in Irondequoit, New York, passed on October 12th. Paul W. Harris Funeral Home is doing the arrangements. Service time is October 17th at 7 p.m., and the location is 570 South Kings Highway in Rochester, New York. Quarterback Allen dinged up as injury crisis hits. Bye week arrives with 19 Bills hurt or on IR. By Ryan Miller, Rochester Democrat and Chronicle, USA Today Network. Even warm-ups weren't safe for the Bills on Monday night. Defensive tackle Daquan Jones injured his calf during pregame warm-ups. The injuries were just during getting warmed up. By the end of the night, five more players left the game with injuries. And that doesn't include quarterback Josh Allen, who grimaced and held his left arm after taking a sack in the second quarter. The Bills limped to the finish line in a 24-14 loss to the Atlanta Falcons. Buffalo enters its bye week 4-2 after an opening stretch that has tested its depth at all three phases of the roster. Bills players on injured reserve or ruled out before the game. Linebacker Matt Milano, pectoral injury, missed his third game of the season after re-aggravating a pectoral injury in week 5. Head coach Sean McDermott called him week to week. Milano has missed 28 games since the start of the 2023 season. Tight end Dalton Kincaid, oblique injury, did not play in week 6 due to an oblique injury. He tested the injury in pre-game warm-ups but was listed as inactive. Kincaid was coming off a career-high 108 yards receiving yards in week 5 and leads the team with 287 yards receiving and 3 touchdown catches. Wide receiver Curtis Samuel, injured in his neck and ribs, missed week 6. Between injuries and healthy scratches, Samuel has played in 2 games this season with 3 receptions for 35 yards and a touchdown. Damar Hamlin has a pectoral injury, suffered the pectoral injury in practice October 9th, was placed on injured reserve, eligible to return in week 11 although Bills coach Sean McDermott said it's, quote, up in the air, unquote, if Hamlin's injury is season ending. Defensive tackle TJ Sanders with a knee injury was placed on injured reserve after suffering a knee injury in practice October 1st that required surgery. The rookie could return in week 11. Tyler Bass, left hip and groin, was placed on injured reserve September 5th after missing most of training camp and two of the three preseason games, was eligible to return as soon as week 5. Cornerback Maxwell Hairston, knee, the rookie first-round pick, suffered a right LCL sprain at training camp practice on July 29th and was off crutches about 2 weeks later, was eligible to return as soon as week 5. Defensive tackle Dwayne Carter has an Achilles injury, tore his Achilles in practice before week 1 and will miss the entire season. Offensive lineman Tylan Grable has a concussion, entered league concussion protocol on August 7th. I'm not sure what P stands for, but anyway, Cameron Johnston has a foot and an ankle, suffered left foot and ankle injuries after taking a hit to his left plant leg on a punt in week 4, eligible to return in week 9. Cornerback Dorian Strong with a neck injury. The rookie sixth rounder played in 4 games with 1 start before suffering a neck injury and being placed on injured reserve on October 4th, eligible to return in week 10. Safety Wandae Owens has an undisclosed injury. The undrafted rookie was waived August 23rd with an injury designation and went unclaimed on waivers. Bills players injured during warm-ups before Monday's game. Defensive tackle DaQuan Jones has a calf injury, hurt his calf in week 6 pregame warm-ups, and was ruled out prior to kickoff. Jones was spotted leaving the locker room in a walking boot after the game. Bills injured during Monday Night Football week in week 6. Wide receiver Joshua Palmer with an ankle injury. Left with an ankle injury after being dragged down on an apparent hip drop tackle after a reception in the second quarter. Palmer did not return. Cornerback Christian Benford has an Achilles injury. He went down with a non-contact injury in the second quarter and returned to start the second half. Linebacker Terrell Bernard had an ankle injury, rolled his ankle in a pileup during the second quarter, initially listed as questionable, but did not re-enter the game. Quarterback Josh Allen, left hand and wrist, rolled onto his back holding his left arm after taking a sack in the second quarter. Allen to sideline, shaking his left hand, but did not miss any plays. Allen told reporters after the game he was not hurt and he's completely healthy. Connor McGovern kicked in the left leg early in the second quarter, missed one play, and then returned. Josh Allen was sacked for a 15-yard loss on the only snap without McGovern. And S, I think, is for safety, Cole Bishop for cramping, left briefly in the second half and returned with 6 minutes and 43 seconds left in the fourth quarter. NFL Week 7 Power Rankings. New number one rises as Lions and Bills lose. By Nate Davis, USA Today. The NFL Power Rankings entering Week 7 of the 2025 season. Previous rank is in parentheses. Number one, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers were 4 last week. If the season ended today, and it doesn't, they'd have home field advantage and the bye in the NFC playoff season. If the season ended today, and it doesn't, quarterback Baker Mayfield would very likely be the deserved league MVP. Number two, Green Bay Packers, were fifth last week. If this seems lofty for a team that hadn't won in a month prior to Sunday, then acknowledge, but it's also partially a function of other clubs failing the pack up the board. But there's no denying the talent present here or the fact that they got much healthier during their bye. Number three, Los Angeles Rams, who were eighth last week. W.R. Puka Nacua's ankle sprain comes at an ideal time. The team parked in Baltimore before it continues east to London. Number four, the Seattle Seahawks, who were 12th last week. A team of road warriors, one that was philosophically built to play nasty defense, check, and run the ball, arguably and surprisingly, has what's probably the league's most potent quarterback-receiver duo at the moment. Number five, the Indianapolis Colts, who were 9th last week. If the season ended today, and it doesn't, they'd have home field advantage and the bye in the AFC playoff field. If the season ended today and it doesn't, quarterback Daniel Jones would very likely be the deserved comeback player of the year. Denver Broncos are in the sixth place. Last week they were 10th. A week after knocking off an undefeated team, they nearly got knocked off by a winless one. Still, this defense may be the league's single most dominant unit. It's 90 sacks since the start of last season, 28, are 28 more than any other team. Number seven, the Buffalo Bills, who were in second last week. In fairness, they're missing a lot of key guys at the moment. And in fairness, their four victories came against clubs with an aggregate 3-21 record. Number eight, the Philadelphia Eagles, who were in third place last week. A team with RB Saquon Barkley and quarterback Jalen Hurts in its backfield is on track to rush for nearly 400 yards fewer than Barkley alone did in 2024. What is happening here? Number nine, the Jacksonville Jaguars, who were sixth last week. Talented young team, 6 days removed from defeating an active dynasty, are prone to letdowns. Let's see how the Jags rebound against the potentially depleted Rams to conclude their three-game, quote-unquote, homestand in London. In 10th place, the Kansas City Chiefs, who were in 14th place last week. Talented, older team, 6 days removed from the banana peel against an upstart, apparently respond with a crisp effort. 4 touchdowns, no penalties, no turnovers against a fellow league power. Number 11 are the Detroit Lions, who were in first place last week. This is an appropriate place to take a pause and ask if it's appropriate to drop a team from first overall to 11th merely because a dominant four-game winning streak was snapped. Maybe not. But first, the Lions, after feasting on lesser competition, were unequivocally handled in their losses by the best teams they've faced so far, the Packers and the Chiefs. And second, the apparent upper echelon of the league is so tightly packed with 14 teams sporting a winning percentage of 0.667 or better, plus 3 more that are 3-2, that it's tough to distinguish those currently clustered together. I'm just going to read the rest, not all the details, just the basic information. In 12th place, the Pittsburgh Steelers, who were 13th last week. In 13th place, the New England Patriots, 15th last week. In 14th place, Chicago Bears, 19th last week. In number 15, the Washington Commanders, 11th last week. 16, San Francisco 49ers, who were in 7th place last week. 17, Los Angeles Chargers, who were in 20th place last week. 18, Houston Texans, 17th last week. 19, Carolina Panthers, 23rd last week. 20th, the Atlanta Falcons, who were in 24th place last week. 21st, Minnesota Vikings, who were 18th place last week. And I think that's all that's here today. Usually it goes a little longer. Okay. Actually, you have been listening to a reading of articles and features from the Democrat and Chronicle on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Commentary For one game, Giants earned respect up front by Art Stapleton, NorthJersey.com, USA Today Network, New Jersey. East Rutherford, New Jersey. The New York Giants left tackle Andrew Thomas stepped onto the field inside MetLife Stadium against the Philadelphia Eagles with a lofty goal versus the reigning Super Bowl champions. It's something the Giants have not done, especially opposite the Eagles, in quite some time. Quote, "We wanted to dominate the line of scrimmage," unquote, Thomas said. And for the first time in a long while, that was not just fantasy for the Giants' offensive line. The mission manifested itself in reality during a performance that led to the Giants' stunning 34-17 victory over the Eagles, a knock-yourself-in-the-mouth effort for the one unit on the team that in particular has been maligned for more than a decade. Quote, "I think we've always had the mentality to do that," Thomas added on October 13th. "I don't think we ever have a lack of effort on this team, but I think it just comes down to execution. Beating the guy across from you, and you're playing with the right technique. You're being physical and with the effort that I talked about. When all three of those come together, then you get results," unquote. The Giants, 2-4, returned to their training facility on October 13th to begin preparation for next Sunday's game, October 19th, against the 4-2 Broncos in Denver, and that requires turning the page on the biggest regular season win for the franchise in years, given all the circumstances. But considering the next defensive challenge that awaits, it's worth revisiting the past one more time. In the post-game locker room celebration, one that culminated in an emotional moment when Giants coach Brian Daboll gave co-owner and team president John Mara the game ball, rookie quarterback Jason Dart spoke up with an additional shout-out for the offensive line that was well-received by all. "The Giants have wanted to build a team that refuses to get bullied between the lines, in back-page headlines and on banners pulled by planes over MetLife Stadium. That was going to take making over a locker room that needed not only help to establish a shift in expectations and results, but also do what's needed to change perspective and performance. The makeover needs to start somewhere, and maybe, just maybe, the Giants are finally getting there." Rookies Jackson Dart and Cam Skadebo represented that against the Eagles, breaking free of the old button-down Giants way that had gotten stale with all the losing around here. Dart has directed the team to 2 wins in his first 3 starts, becoming the 3rd quarterback to rush for at least 50 yards in his first 3 games, joining Lamar Jackson and Jalen Hurts. Skatebo rushed for 3 touchdowns and 98 yards against Philadelphia, sealing the anticipated show from Saquon Barkley. The Eagles especially have made a living by pushing the Giants around, mocking them regardless of the 4 Vince Lombardi trophies that sit in the lobby of their building. This time, the Giants answered back and emphatically. They did not stay quiet either, acknowledging the perception around the team that a while ago became a pushover in the NFC East and beyond. Quote, "We're still building our identity," Thomas said. "What you do consistently, that's who you are," unquote. For one night against the Eagles, the Giants were the Maulers of the Meadowlands on both sides of the ball, and they loved the way it looked on tape watching back one last time prior to putting the focus on the Broncos. Quote, "This is a team that when people come to play the Giants, they're going to have to win it up front," unquote, outside linebacker Kevon Thibodeau said. Quote, "We don't play cute ball, we play smash-mouth football in New York," unquote. The Broncos sacked Jets quarterback Justin Fields 9 times for a loss of 55 yards, and Fields was 9 of 17 for 45 yards. So the Jets had negative 10 net passing yards as Denver made the gangrene offense extremely one-dimensional. Was that on the Jets or are the Broncos with NFL sack leader Nick Bonito, who's number 8, that good? The Giants are going to find out. Quote, "We want to play against the best," Thomas said. "Right now, the Broncos have the most sacks, the most pressures, so we're definitely excited for the challenge." Field hockey. These players are emerging as Section 5's best in 2025. By James Johnson, Rochester Democrat and Chronicle, USA Today Network. As the Section 5 field hockey season speeds quickly into tournament play, it's time to look at some of the top performers from the season so far. A total of 5 members of the 2024 Democrat and Chronicle All-Greater Rochester team returned to their squads this season, including injured Melody Query, Q-U-E-R-I, at Sutherland. None of the other 4 players have allowed their play to go backward and stand out on the list of Section 5's best. Top players are Dylan Bigwar from Fairport, the 2024 All-State and AGR team midfielder. When the Red Raiders score, chances are very high that she has something to do with it. Olivia Batoni from Webster Thomas, a 2024 AGR team member, is a 4th-year starter. Quote, she's extremely fast and efficient on the forward line, unquote, Arondaquit coach Emily Payne said. Athleticism is at a level that there is a plan to play field hockey and lacrosse at SUNY Geneseo. Jane Berger from Brighton, a goalie in her junior year, stopped 72% of the shots she faced, made 63 saves overall during the team's first 8 games. And Hannah Byes from Fairport, a midfielder, is in her 3rd season as a starter after helping the Red Raiders win the 2024 Section 5 Class A Championship, plans to play at Messiah University. Brennan Conlon, C-O-N-L-O-N, from Arondaquit, forward, is a 3rd-year varsity starter who's, quote, able to generate shots in all situations, unquote, Eagles coach Emily Payne said. Charlotte DeBay from Arondaquit, a midfielder, is in her 2nd season as a starter. Her ability to possess the ball in traffic is already notable, according to Arondaquit coach Emily Payne. Sadie Eisenhart from Webster Thomas, the senior midfielder, is described as fast and smart by Titans coach Kyle Smith. Cameron Hernick from Pittsford Mendon, the senior defender, is in her 2nd year as a starter and plans to play at SUNY Geneseo. Hannah Herring from Pittsford Mendon, goalie in her junior year, already has a good grasp about the communication part of her role, allowed just 6 goals in the team's first 9 games. Catherine Hoffman from Fairport has put the ball in the net often for the Red Raiders, including twice October 4th during 2-1 win over Webster Thomas. And Cooper Holden from Webster Schroeder, the senior center midfielder, is a 4th-year starter who is, quote, both offensively and defensively minded and can, quote, make incredible connecting pass or carry the ball 80 yards, unquote, Schroeder coach Caitlin Angelides said. She's committed to play at Division II DeUville. There are quite a few more people. I will just read their names and their schools. That might work. Let's see. Julia Kuhlman from Pittsford Mendon, Kirsten Matsky from Pittsford Sutherland, Vivian Medina from Arondaquit, Kyla Neer from Webster Thomas, Julia Niebuhr from Fairport, Renee Ostberg from Fairport, Lucy Prince Martin from Eastridge, Frankie Rayo from Webster Thomas, Ava Rice from Pittsford Mendon, Raina Sears from Penfield, Kennedy Spencer from Webster Thomas, Eli Wiggins from Pittsford Sutherland, Isabel Williams from Pittsford Sutherland, Morgan Wilson from Pittsford Mendon. And the reporter, James Johnson, who grew up in the city of Rochester, has worked as a full-time journalist covering high school sports for the Democrat and Chronicle since 1996. His career began as an intern during the summer of 1990, before the start of his year at Edison in the Rochester City School District. He has become a 2-time winner of the Rochester Press Radio Club Sports Media Excellence Award. Arizona Attorney General demands Grijalva, G-R-I-J-A-L-V-A, be sworn in by Sadiqa Kochi from USA Today, from Washington, D.C. Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays threatened House Speaker Mike Johnson with legal action if he continues to not formally swear in Democratic Representative-elect Adelita Grijalva, who won the September special election to fill the congressional seat left vacant by her late father. In an October 14th letter addressed to Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, Mays demanded that Grijalva be sworn into office, quote, without further delay, unquote, and that failing to seat her immediately or provide an explanation for when she will be seated, quote, unquote, will prompt legal action. Johnson said in an October 14th news conference that he will swear Grijalva in after the federal government shutdown ends and the House is back in session. Quote, she deserves to have all the pomp and circumstances everybody else does. She deserves to have a full House of members. That hasn't been scheduled because we haven't had that session yet, unquote, he said. It's not clear when the shutdown will end, however, as negotiations between Republicans and Democrats over a funding deal remain at a standstill. The Senate has repeatedly voted on a bill that passed the House last month and would temporarily fund the government, but the bill has failed to advance in the upper chamber. Mays wrote in her letter that Grijalva's swearing in, quote, must be immediate and prior to the date the House comes back into regular session, unquote, and that Johnson must respond to her office within 2 days with, quote, assurance of when and where that will take place. Should you fail to provide such assurance, we will be forced to seek judicial relief to protect Arizona and the residents of its 7th congressional district, unquote, Mays wrote. Grijalva won the September 23rd special election, which includes almost all of the states of the 7th congressional district, which includes almost all of the state's border with Mexico. She is the deciding signature on a petition that would force a vote on a bill to release files related to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Without her sworn in, the paperwork remains stalled. Democrats have claimed Johnson's refusing to swear her in because of the Epstein files issues. Johnson has previously said the bill is unnecessary after a committee released 33,295 pages of records on September 2nd, which had already been released before that. Johnson told USA Today in a statement that, quote, as I've said repeatedly, the House will follow customary practice, unquote. The previous three people who were in the same position, unquote, did not have to wait until their votes certified prior to Johnson swearing them in, she said. The process can take weeks depending on the state, and they were all sworn in the day after their elections. Contributing to this article were Aaron Mansfield and Bart Jansen, USA Today. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the Thursday, October 16th, issue of the Democrat and Chronicle. Your reader has been Betsy Waugh. Thank you for listening.